Good evening. This is Bob Willard, and this is Profiles. Today, we are going to be meeting with Arun Gandhi, grandson of India's late spiritual leader. He lived with his famous grandfather for 18 months, a stay that coincided with the most tumultuous period in India's struggle for independence. In 1991, he and his wife, Sunanda, founded the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Its mission is to examine, promote, and apply the principles of nonviolence. Today is November 1st, and on November 9th, Mr. Gandhi will be speaking at Franklin College here in Indiana. We are talking with him while he's still in Memphis, and we're very delighted he took the time to visit with us. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Most of us here in the United States know very little about your grandfather. Could you share with us what he was like and what were the special qualities that made him one of the most important persons who lived in the 20th century?
Well, I think what really made him very important was the fact that he discovered a new way of resolving conflicts, which was more peaceful and more understanding and compassionate. Also that he was very sincere in his application and his relationships with people. And that, I think, played a very important role in making him so acceptable, because he lived what he wanted people to learn. And he made it a part of his life.
Is this the way that he addressed every issue then that you saw him do, was just to diffuse it and look for a reaction?
Yeah, he always felt that, you know, the only way we can resolve a conflict peacefully is to find a solution that is acceptable to both parties. And that can be done only if we are willing to negotiate with an open mind and not be accusing each other and pointing fingers at each other. And focusing on the negative, but rather focusing on the positive. And if we are willing to do that and are able to do that, and he showed us how he was able to do it. You know, when we fought the British for independence of India, the struggle lasted for nearly 27 years. And in spite of the fact that the British used a lot of violence to disrupt the movement and to, break the resolve of the people. The people themselves, as well as grandfather, never, ever treated the British as enemies. And grandfather was very particular about this. He would even tell anybody who, you know, accidentally referred to them as enemies that not to do that at all. So nobody was an enemy. Everybody was a friend. Some people needed to be needed a change of heart, and that was what we needed to focus on.
And this was all where he resolved his whole sense of nonviolence in reacting to an enemy, if you want to call it here. I mean, we don't want to call it here.
Right.
It was by not reacting, he would get the reaction he wanted.
Right. You know, let me give you an example. When he went to South Africa as a young lawyer in 1895, he had no idea that he was going to be a world figure and that he was going to be a proponent of nonviolence. It all happened accidentally when he was subjected to various racial beatings. His first encounter was in the train when he was thrown off the train because he was traveling in the first class, and black people were not allowed to travel in first class at that time. His second encounter was when a mob, a white mob, surrounded him and almost lynched him if it hadn't been for one white woman who came and rescued him there. So these encounters, made him realize that there was a tremendous conflict and a lot of prejudice, and that we need to fight the conflict and the prejudice and not fight the people. And so even when the police asked him to file complaints against those who had attacked him, he refused to do that. He said that's not the answer, because justice should not mean revenge. Justice should mean reformation. And he said, I don't want these people to be punished for their ignorance. I want to educate them. And so those people were left free, and some of them eventually became very good friends of grandfather's. So, you know, these kinds of incidents we face in our lives every day. But to us, justice means revenge, and so we are so bent on getting revenge, an eye for an eye, that we forget the problem and we just attack the person.
I don't mean to bring this up, but I guess I do, is it seems that one of the problems that was encountered with independence was the whole issue with the Muslims and the Hindus. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be back in the news again today.
Yeah. Well, that was very unfortunate. Yet, you know, if you look at it, he spent a lot of his time, even as he was fighting the British, he gave importance to bringing about Hindu-Muslim unity in destroying the caste system that oppressed people as untouchables. He wanted to create a society in which people didn't have these kinds of prejudices. So he concentrated a lot of his work on that issue, and I think it's primarily for that reason that even when Pakistan was created ostensibly for all the Muslims in Pakistan or in India, only one-third of the Muslims went to Pakistan. Two-thirds decided to continue to stay in India. And I think that was very largely due to the work that grandfather had done. History has not recognized this, but I am pretty certain that if he hadn't worked so sincerely to bring about that communal harmony during his lifetime, two-thirds of the Muslims would not have found the courage and the confidence to continue to stray in a predominantly Hindu India.
You were there when this was happening too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there, and I witnessed a lot of this. He was very pained at the violence that took place there, but he went out and he stopped the violence in East Pakistan, which now has become Bangladesh, and he achieved this all by himself. Even Mountbatten, the last Governor General of British India, recognized this fact when he said that in East Pakistan, Gandhi alone by himself was able to bring peace without killing anybody, whereas in West Pakistan, the Indian Army had to go there, and they brought peace after killing thousands of people. So it's an indication. You know, when we resolve or try to bring peace through violence, we have to kill in order to put fear in the rest of the population not to misbehave. Whereas when you try to bring peace through nonviolence, you try to reform people and bring about a change in their attitudes through love and understanding and compassion.
That's so hard to get across today, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because we have gotten so used to justice meaning revenge, you know. Everybody is constantly harping on that. Even the media, when something happens, they keep talking about how can you bring closure to the situation unless you get the person is punished. And so they instill this kind of attitude in us that we must get punishment for what has been done to us. And that is the unfortunate thing. I think if people can learn that justice is not revenge, an eye for an eye only makes the whole world blind, and what we need is to reform people, I think we'll be able to achieve that much better.
You were there right around the time of independence, weren't you? You were staying with him. You spent 18 months of your life with him at that time?
Yeah, I spent the time with him between late 1945 and late 1947, just after we left for South Africa, the whole family, my parents and my sister and I, in November of 1947, just a couple of months after independence. And a couple of months before grandfather was assassinated.
That was in January of 48?
Yeah, 30th January 1948.
What are your recollections of, you've covered some of them, but just of the intensity of what was going on? You were right there where it was happening, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there and I was witnessing all this, but I was also between the ages of 12 and 14 and not a particularly bright boy, and so I didn't appreciate all the important historic events that were going on. But I did learn some very profound lessons from him through simple things, you know, through storytelling and simple incidents that took place, you know, during my life. And he would turn that around and teach me a very profound lesson there. One of them was learning about nonviolence through a little pencil. A little 3-inch butt of a pencil became the subject of a major lesson for me. And this happened one day when I was coming back from my tuition, and I had this 3-inch pencil in my hand, and I thought that I deserved a better pencil. This was too small for me to use, and so I threw it away. And that evening when I asked Grandfather for a new pencil, he didn't give me one. He subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and why it became small and so on. And then he told me to go out and look for it. And I was shocked. I said, "You don't expect me to look for this pencil in the dark?" He said, "Oh, yes, I do. Here's a flashlight. Take this and go out and look for it." And I went, and I think I spent about 2 to 3 hours searching the bushes for the pencil. And when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, "Now I want you to learn 2 very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources. And that is violence against nature. Lesson number 2 is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all of these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world, and because we overconsume them, we deny these resources to people elsewhere who have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity." And that was the first time I realized that little things that we do every day, you know, things like wasting and throwing away things, food and all the things that we use, all of these little things are acts of violence. And it is this kind of violence, passive violence that we practice all the time, that generates anger in the victim, and the victim then explodes into physical violence. And to drive this lesson home, Grandfather made me draw a family tree of violence, just on the same principles as the genealogical tree. He said, violence is the grandparent, with physical violence and passive violence as the 2 offsprings. And under each one of them, every night before I went to bed, I had to put down my day's experiences, things that I may have read about or seen or even experienced, or things that I may have done to other people. All these actions had to be analyzed and put down on that tree in their appropriate places. And I realized after a couple of years how much of passive violence I was capable of doing. I mean, I wasn't physically violent, but I was very passively violent. I was doing all kinds of things that were acts of violence that hurt other people. And it was only after knowing it and acknowledging it that made it possible for me to change myself. And so it's very important that we learn about our acts of passive violence and acknowledge it and bring about that change. You know, today we live in denial. We don't admit that we are violent because we are only looking at violence from the physical perspective. And so to that extent, we are right that we don't go out and beat up people. But we are very violent in the passive sense because we are inconsiderate. We don't think about other people. We're thinking only about ourselves and what's best for us and, you know, all of these things that we do all the time. And that is what really generates the physical violence, because that's the fuel that ignites the fire of physical violence.
Physical violence, then, would be things like war and murder.
Anything that we use physical force, wars, murders, killings, rapes, beatings, you know, any kind of violence where we use physical force against other people. But passive violence is the type of violence where we don't use any physical force, but we still hurt other people emotionally and other ways.
Are you talking about things like prejudice and suppression or hate and things
right.
of that nature?
All of these things. You know, that's just a part of it. But so many things that we do unconsciously. I mean, prejudice and hate and all that is there, and it comes out in the way we behave with each other. But sometimes, you know, like I said, we throw away things and waste things, and we don't think that we are hurting anybody at all. But all of that is violence, because we are depriving somebody somewhere of those resources.
Does that lead into being a vegetarian and so forth, as he was?
Well, not necessarily, but, you know, I don't believe in the fact that if you are a vegetarian, you're automatically nonviolent. I have seen many very strict vegetarians being very strictly violent, too. So I don't subscribe to that at all. It's a question, of course, vegetarianism is a part of changing process. If we can learn to live with people, we can learn to live with animals and not kill each other there. And so it is one of the steps that we need to take, but it's not necessarily the most important step. Grandfather had four sons, no daughters. My father was the second son, and he was the only one of the four sons who devoted his life entirely to working for nonviolence. That's how we came to be living in South Africa, because that is where Grandfather's transformation began. Like the two experiences I told you earlier, that made him think of ways in which we can get justice, and he resolved that nonviolence was the only way to get justice. So the transformation began in South Africa, and he ended up living there for 22 years and practicing it there against the racist government. And he set up an institute in South Africa. And then in 1915, when he decided to leave and come back to India, he wanted somebody to stay in South Africa and continue with the work. And so my father volunteered to do that. And so he was the only one of the four who was totally committed to this philosophy.
So you were brought up in South Africa then?
Yeah, I was born and brought up there. I lived there for 23 years and left South Africa after my father died, and then lived in India for 30 years and came to this country in 1987.
Wasn't it, you were right there then during the height of apartheid?
Oh, yeah, during the worst years of apartheid. I was there and I experienced it, and it was awful.
Well, weren't you sort of a confused issue? You weren't black, you weren't white, you were brown.
Yeah,
and
so that's why I got beaten up by both sides. At the age of 10, I was beaten by some white youths because they thought I was too black. And then a few months later, I was beaten up by black youths because they thought I was too white. And so it filled me with a lot of anger and rage. And I wanted, like everybody, eye for an eye justice. And that's when my parents took me to India and gave me the opportunity to live with Grandfather and learn from him how to deal with this anger that I was feeling. And that Grandfather taught me a very profound lesson. He said anger is like electricity. It's just as powerful and just as useful and just as deadly. But it all depends on how you use it. So if you use it intelligently, and you can use it for the good of humanity. But if you abuse it, you can destroy yourself and destroy everything around you. So he taught me how to use anger and channel it positively to use it for the good of humanity. He suggested that I should write an anger journal and, write the journal with the intention of finding a solution to the problem and not with the intention of just getting that anger out of your system. A lot of people have been writing journals with the intention of getting the anger out of the system, and the result is that every time they go back and read the journal, they just feel a renewal of the anger. But by writing it with the intention of finding a solution and then committing myself to finding a solution, I was able to channel that energy of anger into positive action rather than abusive action.
It kept you away from the violent response, the right. Physical response.
Right.
Were you ever able to resolve that situation if you moved to India, or were you able to let it go?
No, I didn't move to India of my own free will. I went to India after my father's death. I was 23 at that time, and I wanted to know what my future is going to be, and my father's brothers, two younger brothers who were still living in India, invited me to come over to India and meet with the family and perhaps discuss my future. And so I went with that intention, and I met my wife there, and we fell in love and decided to get married, and the South African government wouldn't allow me to bring her back with me. They said I could come back alone, but not with her. So obviously they wanted to get rid of the Gandhi family because they probably thought that since I was the only male member now after my father's death, that my two sisters and my mother would also leave South Africa and go back with me to India. But they didn't count on the resilience of the Gandhi females. They were determined and powerful, and they decided to live on in fighting apartheid.
And apartheid is no longer.
Yeah, apartheid is no longer.
At least as far as law.
I didn't expect it to go in my lifetime. I thought it's going to take a long, long time to get rid of it. But I was pleasantly surprised that apartheid was dismantled in my lifetime.
Well, that has to have a good feeling for you.
Yeah, it does. In one sense, I feel very distressed in another sense. I'm very happy, of course, that apartheid has been dismantled. But I thought that the new government there will be able to, do some good things and show the world how they can treat poor people with compassion. And instead, they just chose to, get into the saddle and continue with the policies of the white government. In the economic sense, this is exactly what we did in India. We got the British to go away back to their country, and what we basically did was replace the British officials with Indian officials. And we kept the oppressive structure of imperialism intact, so that now our own people are oppressing our own people with that imperialist structure, all the pomp and pageantry and everything that goes with that imperialist structure. And there is, the result is that the gulf between the poor and the rich is widening every day. And South Africa, they did the same thing. The African National Congress just stepped into the pomp and pageantry of the white people and that kind of a lifestyle, and they've created a division between the leaders and the people that is widening, and that's one of the reasons why there's so much of crime in South Africa today, because the ordinary people feel that we also made sacrifices for the independence of South Africa. So why shouldn't we get a piece of the pie, too?
Well, isn't there a feeling that your grandfather got across, at least to the British, that it's your problem, not theirs?
Right. right.
Okay, and so at least it's within the country.
Yeah.
As versus from some outside source.
Right. And what he said was that he was hoping that the Indian leaders would dismantle the whole imperialist structure and live and govern in a way that the poor people would feel part of the whole structure there, and also they would be able to improve their lives economically. But the Indian leadership didn't want that. They wanted to bask in the glory of the British pomp and pageantry. So now they live like kings. They have huge mansions and retinue of servants and a lot of money and all of those things, which goes, you know, against the economy of the country altogether.
But hasn't there been a little bit of a tradition of that prior to the, I mean, not just the English, but...
Yeah, the old Maharajas and all that. Yeah, there is that tradition, but it was a tradition that could have been broken. It wasn't a tradition that we needed to preserve.
Our guest today is Arun Gandhi, the grandson of the famous spiritual leader of India, who's visiting with us prior to a speech he's to give at Franklin College. I'd like to just go back a little bit, Arun, and ask a little bit about your three uncles, the other three brothers. What did they do, and where did they go? And
well, the eldest uncle, he had many psychological problems himself, and so he broke away from the family, and he became an alcoholic, and was totally, lost to the family altogether. The second was my father, and as I said, he was the only one who committed himself to nonviolence. The third and the fourth, they went to India and took up jobs. One was a manager, the third was a manager of a soap factory, and the fourth became the managing editor of a big national daily from New Delhi.
So they went off into the world of commerce.
Right.
Man, that's a change, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
In 1991, you founded the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's headquartered in the Christian Brothers University in Memphis.
Right.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, I came here in 1987 to do a study of the race prejudices in this country and compare it with the caste prejudices that we had experienced in India and the color prejudice that I had experienced in South Africa. And so I had this fellowship, and I came to Mississippi and lived at the University of Mississippi and did this study. It wasn't an academic study. It was just a sort of, studying the situation in general. And one of the things that I felt very strongly after studying this was that the people, both the blacks and the whites, were not aware of the power of nonviolence to resolve these conflicts. And so I decided that we can now set up an institute here and teach people the power of nonviolence. And because we had used this in India for 30 years in the work that my wife and I were doing, and it was very successful there. So that was what motivated us. And I wanted to be on a university campus so that we could reach out to young people. And I wrote to several universities, and Christian Brothers University offered us hospitality. And they said, we can give you accommodation to live and accommodation for the office on the campus, and that would be our contribution. And I said, that's good enough. So we ended up being here. And then, of course, it's appropriate because Memphis was where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And so it's appropriate that we should continue with the work in this city and from this city throughout the nation and hopefully the world.
Well, the whole feeling of rising above religious beliefs was to mean all mankind. So your grandfather, I think, espoused the fact that he didn't care if you were Muslim or Hindu or Jew or Christian. You were all people in the eyes of God, and therefore, you know, let's work together.
Yeah, well, he transcended religion as we know it. You know, we look at religion from a very narrow perspective. And with the brand names that we have given to religion there. And he said that that's fine up to a point, you know, but that shouldn't mean that we should hate other people who believe and believe differently, that there should be a respect for everyone. And, you know, he used to say that religion is like climbing a mountain, that everybody is going up to the same peak, so why should it matter which side of the mountain one chooses to climb up? And so, you know, he wanted a respect for all religions. He wanted people to reach beyond this kind of partisan religions to respecting and living with everybody on equal terms. And That's what he tried to generate among all the people.
It would seem that the core of your grandfather's philosophy is human relationships and how we build it between people.
Right. The two things that we emphasize most through this institute work here is that we need to learn how to use our anger positively rather than abuse it. And we need to learn how to build meaningful relationships between people. And I think if we do these two things, we would be able to reduce the violence in human society very substantially.
Why is this so hard for people to embrace?
I think we have gotten so much into capitalism and materialism, and that has a tendency to make us selfish and self-centered. And so we have, for generations, have been teaching each other that we have to think about ourselves and our own people and our own families and not about other people. And so, you know, that kind of selfish attitude has generated all this prejudice and hate towards others. Anybody who appears to threaten our economic position, we want to take a stand against them. And that's very unfortunate. If we can just realize that human relationships must transcend selfishness and self-centeredness to respect and understanding for each other, then we would be able to have much better relationships.
Would you think that the resurgence in religion that at least is going on in this country is going to result in this kind of thinking?
Well, I do see some trends towards that, not only in this country but elsewhere. But this whole question is very urgent, and I would hope and pray that instead of taking small steps, we begin to take giant steps towards this and break down all the prejudices that we have created through religion. You know, religion is supposed to unite people and take them to salvation and understanding, better understanding of the self and all of that. And instead, we use religion to divide people and create more divisions and hate and prejudice. So we are negating the very essence of religion.
That's so difficult for people to grasp because it gives them nothing to hold on to.
Yeah, it doesn't. No, I don't think it does give them anything to hold on to. I mean, I'm not saying that we give up our religions altogether. What I'm saying is that we understand our religion better and use it to create compassion and understanding for others also, instead of being jealous of our own possessions and creating barriers for others and hate and prejudice that is generated because of that exclusivity. So, you know, I'm not saying that we must give up our religions or melt down. There's no such thing as a melting pot. That's a myth. The thing that we need to do is to learn to live with each other and understand and enhance our own beliefs and all that. And the way we can enhance our own beliefs and our own religion is by respecting others and taking from others what we find useful and incorporating that in our own way of worship and life. And that's what Gandhi did. I mean, he made a friendly study of all the religions and took from every one of them what he found useful. And the emphasis is on the word friendly. Now, a lot of critical studies have been made by people, but not many friendly studies. So we've got to have that kind of an open mind where we can study, make a friendly study, and learn to respect each other, accept each other for who they are, and through that acceptance we reach an appreciation of our humanity. So, this is what we need to do. Because the world is shrinking very fast. Every country is becoming so, the population is becoming so different. And we all have to learn to live with each other. I mean, there's difference, not only physical differences, but also differences in ideas and ideologies and all of this. So if we continue to fight with each other and destroy each other, we're going to destroy the whole world. I mean, why has the 20th century become the most violent century in human history? And yet we say that humanity is progressing towards civilization. Now, the two don't go together. If we are progressing towards civilization, we ought to be able to reduce violence to the bare minimum. But instead, we find that we use more and more violence, and we're becoming more and more aggressive towards each other. And that doesn't go with civilization.
Is the work or the philosophy of your grandfather still working in India?
No, it's not. Not at the government level. But it is working very much at the grassroots level. As I told you earlier, the government of India decided much before independence that they were not going to make nonviolence a state policy, and they were not going to follow it at all. So they just threw it overboard. So at the official level, nonviolence was never a part of the Indian government's philosophy. But at the grassroots level, lots of people who were influenced by grandfather during his lifetime and even after his lifetime have dedicated their lives to continuing with the silent revolution and working in the communities and bringing about a change there. And that kind of work is going on a very large scale, but nobody really takes note of it because, the tendency in the media is always to focus on the negative rather than the positive.
But we had it happen here in the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, not recently, but it certainly changed our nation.
Yes, yes, it did. And the tragedy in both cases was that the people themselves didn't realize that this revolution didn't end with gaining civil rights and equality or independence. But it was the first step towards a greater revolution to bring about a change in our attitudes. And we just gave up after this, and we didn't do anything to follow up. And so today we find ourselves in a further mess.
Well, if you were to sum up then the needs, the real needs of the world today, what would they be?
I would sum up and say that what the world needs to learn is how to use their anger positively and how to build good relationships, and that we need capitalism, but we need compassionate capitalism, not greedy capitalism. We need people to be more understanding and compassionate towards each other and be willing to lend a helping hand, in a constructive way. So we need to live as a human society where we would be able to help each other.
What about your personal ethics and beliefs that have governed your life?
Well, I've tried to follow in grandfather's footsteps, and I think I was very fortunate since, as I said, my father and my mother both dedicated their lives to this philosophy. So I had a very good childhood and upbringing from them. And I've tried to constantly improve my life, and through my life I've tried to improve those who come in touch with me and spread the word as best I can. I wouldn't say I'm perfect, but I'm working towards it.
And your wife is very active with you.
Yeah,
on this.
We have been married for nearly 41 years, and we have always worked jointly, collaboratively, together in all the things that we do.
Children?
We have two, a son and a daughter. Both are grown up and they are married. They also have two children each. And they are also doing in their own way whatever they can to further this philosophy.
So it's got that expanding, the grassroots grows.
Oh,
it doesn't
yeah.
take but a small percentage to make a big difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it has that potential. Yeah, one of the things I was saying in another radio interview on the West Coast is that the United States has reached a point when it should change its foreign policy from what is good for the United States to what is good for the world, and try to use the knowledge and understanding that they have achieved to help the rest of the world attain a better standard of living. And unless the United States does this, you know, it's going to find itself isolated by the rest of the world, because they look upon the United States with envy and say, if they can have all these things, why can't we have anything? And so we have this whole resurgence of terrorism and attacks on the United States, because if they can't get what they need, they're going to destroy what they can't get. And it's going to be a vicious cycle. So I think the United States needs to broaden its perspectives and become more friendly throughout the world, rather than being so selfish and self-centered and thinking only about what's good for the U.S.
So what you're saying then is that the current leaders of the country, of each nation, of the rest of the world, needs to go back and espouse the same things that one individual said 100 years ago.
Right.
And that is that nonviolence works, that love your neighbor.
Yeah. And the United States has the power to influence the rest of the world because of its power. If they take it into, you know, their... make it a state policy. I'm not saying become nonviolent nation, and I'm not saying that we disband our army and all that, but I'm saying that we become more compassionate towards the rest of the world and try to help reduce levels. You know, we've become very good crisis managers. We have taken upon ourselves the policing of the world. Wherever there is a violence or crisis, we want to intervene and use our force and put down that violence. And I think we need to grow out of that and become more proactive and look at conflicts before they become a crisis and intervene properly at the right moment with economic help and social help so that we can avoid crises. You know, for an example, Somalia, when we intervened in Somalia when that nation was consumed by violence. And so to end that violence, we went and used force to bring about some sanity. And yet that violence was generated by 10, 12 years of continuous agricultural losses, which caused economic deprivation and all kinds of terrible agonies for the people. And it was when they couldn't sustain this that they became violent. Now, we spent, or the United Nations spent, $2 billion in trying to keep peace in Somalia. And if those $2 billion had been spent 10 years earlier to help the agriculture in Somalia, we wouldn't have seen the crisis in Somalia, the crisis of violence. That money would have been better spent, and we would have transformed the economy of that country, and they would have been living in a much better situation.
Arun, unfortunately, our time is about up. Is there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us before we go off the air?
Well, I would just like to tell all the people a very happy new year, because I won't be here for the millennium change in the new year, and I hope that we will work, all of us together will work to make the next year and the next century and the next millennium a more peaceful and less violent place for all of humanity to live in.
Our guest tonight has been Arun Gandhi, grandson of Gandhi, the great spiritual leader of India. He is also the founder of the Institute for Nonviolence and is here in Indiana to be speaking at Franklin College on the 9th of November, 1999, and took some time away from his schedule to visit with us. We thank you so much for spending this time with us, Arun. This is WFIU. I'm Bob Willard. Good evening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in November of 1999. Christina Kuzmich, producer. Engineering and editing by Michael Paskash and John Shelton. For WFIU, thanks for listening.